Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. Today, I'm going to have an audio interview from internationally renowned natural health physician and Mercola.com founder, Dr. Joseph Mercola. He's interviewing Ellen Brown, who is the civil litigation attorney and author of The Web of Debt, which we have gone very deeply into, and he's going to talk to her about the politics of health as well as forbidden medicine. And it, of course, relates to the big central banking issues that confront us. You can actually watch this on the YouTube. Dr. Mercola interviews Ellen Brown about politics of health. And this will be a continuation of the last show, and it will bring out a lot more details related to banks.
Well, I'm glad that it seems that actually is a model that would work, because, and you're right, it is costly. I think it costs several million dollars to get that ballot, the GMO labeling on the ballot in California. But it's exciting, it's encouraging, because that is a model that can work. And that's why I'm really excited to be connecting with you, because as I mentioned earlier, I've long been aware of the challenges with our whole economic model, but it's only a recent appreciation of the connection between the banking industry and health, as we talked about earlier, that is so massive. But it's true for just about every problem we have. We can almost trace it back to the bankers. So it's the fundamental pernicious evil that's ruining the culture. So I think once people understand that concept at a deep level, it's going to be an easy step. But of course, there's a lot of logistics to help them understand that and then develop the funding to get these ballot initiatives passed. But I think it's a marvelous model, and I really applaud you for what you're doing and really waking us, because it's my approach as a physician is to treat the root cause. I mean, if you treat symptoms like the drug model has us doing, it's a marvelous model for the drug companies, because they're going to make lots of money for long term and not cure a darn thing. And in many ways, that's what we're doing with a lot of these problems. We're not treating the symptom, but the cause. And that's what you're promoting here, is to treat the foundational root cause, which is a corrupted banking system. And providing a public banking seems to be a really marvelous solution. And it's been proven in North Dakota. We know it works, and 40% of the world. I'm sorry, I just got excited about that.
And I want to say I applaud what you're doing, too.
Yeah, because
you're doing great work.
But you know, because it really is important to get all of these issues together, and you know, it's been helpful for me to understand your perspective, because I really think it is key, not only in the health industry, but I mean, well, specifically in the health industry, because that's what we focus on. But it's to get this agreement on, to recognize who the real enemy is, and once you focus on that, forget about the differences you have, because they're almost irrelevant. When you look at the bigger picture, and I think that really is the message here, is to look at the big picture, and that really you help us understand with the great investigative work you've been doing.
I think that's that's the good of the Occupy Wall Street movement. They really haven't come through with a plan, but they have focused on who the culprit is here. I mean, the one thing we can agree on here is that Wall Street is at fault. It was not our fault. It was not. It's actually not the government's fault that their budgets collapsed. It was because they couldn't collect taxes, because business fell off, because of what happened on Wall Street. So at least they're focusing on the problem, at least.
Yes, and there was a book that was published recently by Dan Ariely, and we wrote an article about it, and I forget the specific title of it, but his name is Ariely, and he's a really interesting, innovative researcher, and uncovering some foundational truths about human behavior. And his research showed that just about everyone lies, 98% of the people. About 1% of people will lie all the time, and about another 1% of people will never lie. It's a fascinating book, and I think we showed an interview he did with the Wall Street Journal. But the fascinating component of it is he looked at all the specific details that motivates people to this type of behavior, and ultimately it's always some type of personal internal justification that it's okay for them to do this. And I think that's it became really clear to me that's exactly what's happened in government. You know, that their intention was pure it's well-intentioned, but then you've got these corrupting influences, and they justify it, and it just becomes worse and worse and worse. And over decades and centuries, it becomes essentially a system that is inevitable. It's going to fail. It's just so corrupted. So, I think we've gotten to that point here, clearly in the banking industry, and thankfully, most people are starting to become aware of this, and it's just really become really patently clear to most of us that this is the issue. And thankfully for investigators like you who are really helping people understand and providing practical resources and organizations that people who feel strongly about this can participate in. Yeah, so I'm wondering, if you could, maybe if you, we could kind of close up now and maybe, but before we do, why don't you provide some resources that you would recommend if people are interested in learning more about this and how they could become active and involved?
Well, our public banking website is publicbankinginstitute.org, and we have lots of information on there. And my website for Web of Debt is webofdebt.com, and I have over 130 articles on there, on mostly on banking, but there are a few on health. I wrote a book on dentistry, and so I did write an article on the Mercury issue when that came to a head with the FDA, etc. And I have over 500 interviews on there too. So
wow, terrific. Well, you've been busy.
Yeah.
So are there, obviously it's a lot to cover in a relatively short interview, and you've been studying this for a year, so those are good resources that people can participate in if they want to learn more. But are there any closing comments you'd like to mention to emphasize, or any specific points?
Well, this has sort of fired me up just, researching for your interview. It just reminded me of all these health issues that I really want to get back into, but I think we can solve this problem. We can solve the healthcare issue. We can't afford it. We can't afford our current system, but we could afford a system that would take care of everybody. It's just that we have the wrong approach toward health. And if we understood, if we tried to work with the body, it would be much cheaper, and we could have healthcare for all.
Yeah, I kind of look at the impending economic collapse, and I kind of believe that that's where we're heading. I think it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. And there's going to be a lot more pain and suffering than we even had in 2008. But I think that's a good thing. It's kind of, in some ways, like an alcoholic. Many don't get better until they're in the gutter. And that this will force people to look for alternatives. And really, one of the foundations that people need is their health. I mean, what does it matter if you have all the wealth in the world if you're not healthy? So that the conventional model simply does not work. It's proven time and time again. I mean, it works other than for acute medical traumas, which, of course, it's the best. But for the chronic disease and prevention and treatment, it just is a miserable failure.
I'd like to take a moment for station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond.
So really this need, this motivation based upon an economic collapse, I think would be a powerful reason why people would start to become motivated to pursue these natural therapies and strategies and really provide a system. And it's interesting that you commented earlier on the public banking in Canada. I wasn't aware of that, that is actually what provided the revenues and the resources for the health model, essentially provided for free because they weren't paying interest to the bankers. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean it has to subsidize a system of conventional medicine, which is, again, really at its root core, have the bankers behind it, but it can really subsidize a system that's, and that's really what's the problem with any, in my view, any socialized medicine, is that its foundational core is going to be paying for healthcare that is based on conventional models, which we know don't work and only continue to make the system worse. It just gets to be this vicious cycle. I'm really excited to connect with you. I'm really grateful for all the work you've been doing, and hopefully we'll be able to work together in the future as we address some of these other issues that are sort of on our plate now with this labeling campaign in California, and hopefully would be the beginning of the end of GMOs in the United States and hopefully the world, which I think will be good. Well, thanks again for all you're doing, and I'm sure we'll connect again soon.
So that was Dr. Mercola interviewing Ellen Brown about politics of health, and also she brought into her answers a whole angle on banks and the banks' influence on the economy and health. And you can go to YouTube and watch the entire interview under Dr. Mercola interviews Ellen Brown about politics. Now I'd like to start another angle on debt, investigating it from a different perspective and focusing on how there have been programs and systems to actually generate debt on a global level for the benefit of corporations and governments. I'm going to go into a New York Times bestseller by John Perkins, his first book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. In the riveting story of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins tells his own inner journey from willing servant of empire to impassioned advocate for the rights of oppressed people. Covertly recruited by the United States National Security Agency and on the payroll of an international consulting firm, he traveled the world to Indonesia, Panama, Ecuador, Colombia, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and other strategically important countries. His job was to implement policies that promoted the interests of the U.S. corporatocracy, which is a coalition of government, banks, and corporations, while professing to alleviate poverty, policies that alienated many nations, and ultimately led to September 11th and growing anti-Americanism. Perkins' story illuminates just how far he and his colleagues, self-described as economic hitmen, were willing to go. He explains, for instance, how he helped to implement a secret scheme that funneled billions of Saudi Arabian petrodollars back into the U.S. economy and that further cemented the intimate relationship between the Islamic fundamentalist House of Saud and a succession of American administrations. Perkins reveals the hidden mechanics of imperial control behind some of the most dramatic events in recent history, such as the fall of the Shah of Iran, the death of Panamanian President Omar Torrijos, and the U.S. invasions of Panama and Iraq. By the way, this book was published in 2004. The book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which many people warned Perkins not to write, exposes the little-known inner workings of a system that fosters globalization and leads to the impoverishment of millions of people across the planet. It is a compelling story that also offers hope and a vision for realizing the American dream of a just and compassionate world that will bring us greater security. And I highly recommend that anyone who finds what I'm going to go through interesting should go and get the book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. John wrote that in 1982 as the beginning of a book with the working title Conscience of an Economic Hitman. The book was dedicated to the presidents of two countries, men who had been his clients, whom he respected and thought of as kindred spirits, Jaime Roldós, president of Ecuador, and Omar Torrijos, president of Panama. Both had died in fiery crashes. Their deaths were not accidental. They were assassinated because they opposed that fraternity of corporate, government, and banking heads whose goal is global empire. The EHMs failed to bring Roldós and Torrijos around, and the other type of hitmen, the CIA-sanctioned jackals, who were always right behind them, stepped in. Perkins was persuaded to stop writing that book. He started it four more times during the next 20 years. On each occasion, his decision to begin again was influenced by current world events, the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989, the first Gulf War, Somalia, the rise of Osama bin Laden. However, threats or bribes always convinced him to stop. In 2003, the president of a major publishing house that is owned by a powerful international corporation read a draft of what had become Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He described it as a riveting story that needs to be told. Then he smiled sadly, shook his head, and told Perkins that since the executives at World Headquarters might object, he could not afford to risk publishing it. He advised Perkins to fictionalize it. But Perkins did not want to give a fiction. It's a true story of his life. A more courageous publisher, one not owned by an international corporation, agreed eventually to help him tell it. According to Perkins, the story must be told. He says we live in a time of terrible crisis and tremendous opportunity. The story of this particular economic hitman is the story of how we got to where we are and why we currently face crises that seem insurmountable. According to Perkins, the story must be told because only by understanding our past mistakes will we be able to take advantage of future opportunities. Because 9/11 happened, and so did the second war in Iraq. Because in addition to the 3,000 people who died on September 11, 2001, at the hands of terrorists, another 24,000 died from hunger and related causes. In fact, 24,000 people die every single day because they are unable to obtain life-sustaining food. Most importantly, his story must be told because today, for the first time in history, one nation has the ability, the money, and the power to change all this. It is the nation where he was born and the one he served as an EHM, the United States of America. So then what finally convinced John Perkins to ignore the threats and bribes and to go ahead and write the book? His short answer is that my only child, Jessica, graduated from college and went out into the world on her own. When he told her that he was considering publishing the book and shared his fears with her, she said, quote, "Don't worry, Dad. If they get you, I'll take over where you left off. We need to do this for the grandchildren I hope to give you someday." That's John's short answer. His longer version relates to his dedication to the country where he was raised, to his love of the ideals expressed by our founding fathers, to his deep commitment to the American Republic that today promises life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people, everywhere, and to his determination after 9/11 not to sit idly by any longer while EHMs turn that republic into a global empire. And of course, we'll get into some details about that answer. Now a moment for station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you're listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. When we go through this, we recognize a true story. one lived by a real person, where the sights, the people, the conversations, and the feelings described were all part of his life. It was his personal story, and yet it happened within the larger context of world events that have shaped American history, have brought us to where we are today, and form the foundation of our children's futures. And for him, it's not just American children, it's children across the globe. John's publisher asked whether they actually referred to themselves as economic hitmen. He assured them that they did, although usually only by the initials. He says, in fact, on the day in 1971, when he began work with his teacher, Claudine, she informed him, quote, "My assignment is to mold you into an economic hitman. No one can know about your involvement, not even your wife." Then she turned serious. "Once you're in for life." After that, she seldom used the full name. They were simply EHMs. He goes on and says, Claudine's role is a fascinating example of the manipulation that underlies the business he had entered. Beautiful and intelligent, she was highly effective. She understood his weaknesses and used them to her greatest advantage. Her job and the way she executed it exemplify the subtlety of the people behind this system. She pulled no punches when describing what he would be called upon to do. His job, she said, was to encourage world leaders to become part of a vast network that promotes U.S. commercial interests. In the end, those leaders become ensnared in a web of debt that ensures their loyalty. We can draw on them whenever we desire to satisfy our political, economic, or military needs. In turn, they bolster their political positions by bringing industrial parks, power plants, and airports to their people. The owners of U.S. engineering construction companies become fabulously wealthy. That's the end of a quote. He says that today the system has run amok. Executives at the most respected companies hire people at near slave wages to toil under inhumane conditions in Asian workshops. Oil companies wantonly pump toxins into rainforest rivers, consciously killing people, animals, and plants, and committing genocide among ancient cultures. The pharmaceutical industry denies life-saving medicines to millions of HIV-infected Africans. 12 million families in our own United States worry about their next meal. The energy industry created Enron. The accounting industry created Anderson. The income ratio of 1/5 of the world's population in the wealthiest countries to the 1/5 in the poorest went from 30-1 in 1960 to 74-1 in 1995. At the point the book was written in 2004, the United States had spent over $87 billion conducting a war in Iraq, while the United Nations estimates that for less than half that amount, we could provide clean water, adequate diets, sanitation services, and basic education to every person on the planet. So he raises the question, we wonder why terrorists attack us? He goes on and says that some would blame our current problems on an organized conspiracy. He says he wishes it was so simple. Members of a conspiracy can be rooted out and brought to justice. The system, however, is fueled by something far more dangerous than conspiracy. It is driven not by a small band of men, but by a concept that has become accepted as gospel. The idea that all economic growth benefits humankind, and that the greater the growth, the more widespread the benefits. This belief also has a corollary, that those people who excel at stoking the fires of economic growth should be exalted and rewarded, while those born at the fringes are available for exploitation. He emphasizes that, of course, this concept is erroneous. We know that in many countries, economic growth benefits only a small portion of the population and may in fact result in increasingly desperate circumstances for the majority. This effect is reinforced by the corollary belief that the captains of industry who drive the system should enjoy a special status, a belief that is the root of many of our current problems and is perhaps also the reason why conspiracy theories abound. When men and women are rewarded for greed, greed becomes a corrupting motivator. when we equate the gluttonous consumption of the earth's resources with the status approaching sainthood, when we teach our children to emulate people who live unbalanced lives, and when we define huge sections of the population as subservient to an elite minority, we're asking for trouble. And we get it. In their drive to advance the global empire, corporations, banks, and governments, collectively called corporatocracy, use their financial and political muscle to ensure that our schools, businesses, and media support both the fallacious concept and its corollary. They have brought us to a point where our global culture is a monstrous machine that requires exponentially increasing amounts of fuel and maintenance, so much so that in the end, it will have consumed everything in sight and will be left with no choice but to devour itself. The corporatocracy is not a conspiracy, but its members do endorse common values and goals. The corporatocracy is not a conspiracy, but its members do endorse common values and goals. One of corporatocracy's most important functions is to perpetuate and continually expand and strengthen the system, the lives of those who make it, and their accoutrements, their mansions, yachts, private jets, are presented as models to inspire us all to consume, consume, consume. Every opportunity is taken to convince us that purchasing things is our civic duty, that pillaging the earth is good for the economy and therefore serves our higher interests. Perkins said that people like him are paid outrageously high salaries to do the system's bidding. If they falter, a more malicious form of hitman, the jackal, steps to the plate. And if the jackal fails, then the job falls to the military. His book is a confession of a man who, back when he was an EHM, was part of a relatively small group. People who play similar roles are more abundant now. They have more euphemistic titles, and they walk the corridors of Monsanto, General Electric, Nike, General Motors, Walmart, and nearly every other major corporation in the world. John Perkins says that Confessions of an Economic Hitman is their story as well as his own. He says it is also our story, the story of our world, of the first truly global empire. History tells us that unless we modify this story, it is guaranteed to end tragically. Empires never last. Every one of them has failed terribly. They destroy many cultures as they race toward greater domination, and then they themselves fall. No country or combination of countries can thrive in the long term by exploiting others. And as we will learn as we go through his book, we need to take heed and remold our story. He is certain that when enough of us become aware of how we are being exploited by the economic engine that creates an insatiable appetite for world's resources and results in systems that foster slavery, we will no longer tolerate it. We will reassess our role in a world where a few swim in riches and the majority drown in poverty, pollution, and violence. We will commit ourselves to navigating a course towards compassion, democracy, and justice for all. But where we are is seeing the problem and admitting to it, which is the first step toward a solution. As he says, confessing a sin is the beginning of redemption, and this was his sin. He wants it to be the start of not only his salvation, but our salvation. He wants it to inspire us to new levels of dedication and drive us to realize our dream of balanced and honorable societies. And I will continue with the story in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.